I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the ninth Cinema Podcast of 2018.
Somebody gave Niall sugar.
Niall is having a very bad day.
Niall and four superfluous co-hosts.
So it's a big news day today. We've lost one of our Irish cultural institutions, but we'll get to that in the news. We'll start off with a film apiece from each of the guys around the table. Darren, you want to start off?
I saw Mom and Dad, which opened last week. Didn't make the top 10, so we won't be talking about it later. Really, really liked it. It's great fun. It is from the director of, or one of the directors, of the two Crank films.
Masterpieces, both.
I still haven't seen the second one,
but so
it's probably better.
Really? It's the Godfather 2 of Jason Statham.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
But yeah, and Mom and Dad is great fun. It's perhaps a little awkwardly paced, but it knows what it's doing. There's a remarkable management of tone, actually, which strikes me very well. Because one of the things about horror films is that the unwritten rule is you don't really kill animals or children, particularly if you want the audience to have fun while they're watching it. Whereas, on the other hand, the entire premise of Mom and Dad is about parents going wild and trying to murder their kids.
But are the animals okay?
That would be a spoiler. I don't think
there is any significant animal.
Yeah, just children grace your favorite.
I was okay anyway. Yeah. I didn't get upset at any point.
But no, it actually masters it. It manages tone very, very well for a film that is primarily about infanticide, involving parents turning and murdering their own kids. Yeah. It's a really enjoyable fun ride.
It's funny how Cage is a hero in a film where parents are murdering their kids.
It's really comical and horrifying in an instant. It's really impressive how they manage that. And I like the way you say it's awkwardly paced and that it's really awkward to travel at huge speed all the time.
Yeah.
It's just...
I'm seeing it on Saturday and I cannot wait.
It whizzes by.
It really does.
And it's the kind of stuff that Crank guys do. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's a zombie movie but with parents. And it's got that wonderful sort of 70s like Assault on Precinct 13 sort of vibe to it as well.
You're kidding me. I just want to watch it tonight.
The opening credits are designed in sort of grindhouse style. Yeah. It's got like... I didn't know that I needed a movie where, and this is not a spoiler because it's in the opening credits, where Lance Henriksen plays Nicolas Cage's father,
Oh my God.
Just leave that.
God, did I
need that? That's all I needed to know. I didn't need to know anything
else.
That's
amazing.
The tagline. Yeah.
But yeah, so I saw that and I loved it. But that's me this week. Jay?
Yeah, I'll say a few, but I'll mention just the one. Punisher Warzone.
Yay!
Which is shockingly excellent.
It's
yes,
the best
yes.
Punisher adaptation.
Yeah, but that people say that in a very kind of it's the best of
it's
age.
A low bar.
Yeah, but I watched it just because I still have my last vestiges of my Sky Movies Now TV free trial, which I still have to watch the
I like that. Yeah,
one, which I can watch tomorrow. But
so you know they have like the entire Twin Peaks box set. Yeah, they have every
Stanley
Kubrick film.
It, basically. So,
Jay was like,
I got the Oscars, and so I flicked through the other night and I came across Punisher Warzone, and I watched it for two reasons. One, because I wanted Lexi Alexander. It's good for action stunt kind of stuff from wherever, which I knew. And two,
Ray Stevenson.
Yes. This is great, right? Yes. So I was like, watch, it's an 18th rated Marvel film. You're not going to see that
anytime
soon. No. And it's terrific. It has this weird, and I mean weird, gleeful, anarchic mayhem vibe with Dominic West playing a Dick Tracy villain, essentially.
Yeah.
In bringing weird tonal shifts that's handled really well, but it's so many
there's like a beautiful scene with him and his brother set to, I think, like it's a US recruiting speech.
Oh, it's crazy fantastic. Weird. And the violence is carnal. There's fists go through faces, through heads.
There's like rocket launchers versus parkour.
Yeah, there's a guy parkours off a building in the air and then rocket launcher
there's
blows
a moment
up into
where air. Ray Stevenson dangles himself from a chandelier with a pair of submachine guns.
And wipes out the whole room as he turns.
Even the most impressive thing about it. It's very much
unbelievably well staged.
It's a fantastic, and it's fantastic tone as well. It's very much in keeping with, say, Garth Ennis's work in the early 2000s on it.
It's great, and it has
really
a
dark
kind of 1980s commando type physical film.
The best description I've heard of it is it's the best Steven Seagal movie never made.
And that's actually an impressively complimentary kind of thing.
No, it is.
Just doesn't have Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
And the other thing I'd say, it's 100 minutes long. Like, I mean,
it
this
a
is...
a short movie. It gets an
it's a short movie. It's excellent. Yeah. Like, do watch. It's great.
It is. It's really good.
Other Punisher film, on the other hand, the Thomas Jane one.
I like the Thomas Jane one. It's not anywhere near as good.
Probably not going to see it after this. Nothing could be this good.
I mean, it's fine. Not that bad. Yeah. John Travolta's the villain.
And oh, it, no, you'd need to see this. This is top notch.
It also misses out on like the nihilism that makes a character like the Punisher so much fun as well. Yeah. Although he did do that short Dirty Laundry, I think, which was Thomas Jane's last turn in the role with Ron Perlman, in which he plays a non-copyright infringing version of the Punisher in like a fan film starring Ron Perlman.
It sounds so weird.
It is so weird, but it's great because it's like you could tell that he really, it's like one of those he really wanted to do this thing. He got a one shot at it and that one shot was terrible. So when a bunch of kids showed up with a camera, he was like, sure, why not, I'll do it.
And we're going to Hellboy for good measure.
Yeah.
All right. I'm probably going to cast
it. Find that online. It's only like 6 minutes long.
All right, I'll watch that. Well, in lieu of not watching the Thomas Jane one.
Because Thomas Jane deserves your love.
No, Ray Stephen has my love. That's enough.
So lovely. So apparently for research purposes and apparently just because I really, really loved it, I revisited already one of my Dublin Film Fest favourites, The Image You Missed. The new Donald Foreman documentary.
Damn it, I missed that because it was rescheduled.
The image Jay missed.
Yeah, and I'm still...
Really, really terrific.
I'm so disgusted that I missed it.
Yeah, yeah. The general setup is that his father has died, who... he was an American who went to Belfast and made films about the Troubles, sort of for about 20 to 30 year period. And it's Donald Foreman's effort to reconcile his father's politics with his own, but also his cinematic style with his own. He never knew his father, so it's kind of finding the father in the films. And it's really, really interesting the way he did it.
Yeah,
he does it.
So after the father died, he got access to all this archive material of his work. Alistair Craig is the father. It's very interesting because it's about a person living outside their own, you know, community, observing this. And Donald Foreman himself lives outside of Ireland. He lives in New York now. It is very, very interesting.
It feels like it's kind of very layered.
It really is. There's a lot going on. Obviously, it's intensely personal, but there's a lot going on about Irish identity and how we relate to it, how we relate to Irish identity as sort of excluding the North in a lot of ways. And I also, thankfully, YouTube has a couple of examples of his father's films where you can watch the full thing.
Oh, yeah,
these like hour-long documentaries. I watched a couple of those, and they're really fascinating. It's, you know, really intense footage. You got really thick in there with the IRA, so you get these sort of, and a lot of the best clips from these are in Donald Foreman's documentary. But there's some incredible scenes of, you know, IRA people walking into discos and making a little speech before people start their dancing.
The good old days, eh?
Yeah.
Wholesome family
if
fun.
If you pair it with Sinead O'Shea's The Mother Brings Her Son to Be Shot, which is what's happening now, and there are still Republicans out in the open policing the communities within the North.
Yeah.
And so, this, I mean, as much as things have changed, they haven't in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds great. I would need to watch that.
Great.
I only saw one new film this week. I went to see Dunkirk at the IMAX Film Festival, which I had already seen, and in the interest of not getting anything started,
it was fantastic.
The only thing the IMAX added was volume, really, but that was fine. Anyway, I went to see I, Tonya on Sunday, finally, which I have to say I did not like as much as I thought I was going to.
Same.
Yeah, like I thought it was good. It was something about the editing really took me out of it. The way they kept cutting back to sort of that interview format didn't really work for me. But the performances were very good. Although I don't think Allison Janney was the best in it, so I'm not entirely sure why she's been showered in awards.
I did also
about
say this.
Listeners can't hear Jay agreeing, but he is.
Well, my description of the sweary Deirdre Barlow is standing.
Yes, that's actually very accurate.
And that seems to be all she kind of does. And I love Jenny. She's great. And she can do that kind of stuff in her sleep, but it's similar to Frances McDormand. I don't think she's doing anything that... Interesting. Robbie is much, much better in performance terms.
Robbie was fantastic.
Especially towards the end, I think, when, you know, she's kind of confronted with the magnitude of the punishment. And I mean, there's a whole conversation to be had around that and how seemingly excessive it was compared to the other sentences handed out. Margot Robbie was very good. And for the most part, I can't really fault the performances. I just felt like something about it didn't really coalesce in a way to make it great. But it was enjoyable.
I think it for the first hour or the first half, it certainly it wears its Scorsese influences, its Wolf of Wall Street influence on its back pretty openly. But the thing about those things is, it's actually very difficult to do, as What's-His-Face found out when he made American Hustle. David Russell. It's
counterpoint.
Actually,
Paul
it's
Thomas
very,
Anderson's first two films.
Yeah, but Paul Thomas Anderson grew out of that.
I know.
This, but that was like David Russell's like fifth film.
Okay.
You know, it's like, you know,
we're
you
not
know,
legislating American Hustle. I'm not defending American Hustle.
It sounds like you're defending American
I'm
Hustle.
I'm defending I, Tonya here.
No, I, Tonya gets much better when it settles down in the second half. When the drama seeps ahead of the style, yeah. It's a better film. And they, in my opinion, it would have been wise to start that way rather than try to ape something that's already been done. That's all I'm saying.
All right.
And there's an actor, Paul Walter Hauser, who plays the guy that...
Sean.
He's kind of chubbyish guy. That,
Sean.
Yeah, that he is magnificent.
He put me off eating for
He is so good,
what?
Though.
Jesus. All I could think, like, we were sitting there, my sister and I, watching it, and then when it was over, we just looked at each other and was like, any appetite I've ever had has just evaporated from having to look at him.
He's
drowning in his own film.
He is such
eating
a good
eating is the one thing he put you off, out of all the things that he did in the film.
Yes.
Okay.
He's
other
genuinely
morally questionable things were going on there, but yes, the eating.
He's low key great though.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He's been in
I mean,
a few
the entire cast
I've seen
is great.
He's very, very good.
The entire cast is great, particularly at the end where they do the actual video clips as well and show you the interviews that inspired.
Yeah, but you do. I'm kind of sick of that.
I am generally kind of sick of that.
Like, here's the real people. Yeah, we know you did impersonations. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's a.
I know it's not the impersonation, it's more the content, the actual discussion about whether or not he trained overseas internationally consulted.
I think that there was probably value in putting that in there to be like, yes, this was actually this ludicrous in real life.
To be honest, what's it called, that film Animal House kind of destroyed that, all that kind of idea of end credits thing. Remember had fake end credits, like, you know, whatever his name is, shot by his own troops in Vietnam kind of thing. This is what happens to them next, you know, that kind of thing. So I kind of mocked that mercilessly, and I kind of can't take any of that kind of thing seriously anymore.
I mean, you were the one who was suggesting that, yeah, the...
I suggest somebody on Twitter
the
said...
The 1517 to Paris should end with pictures of actors who
would have
played.
That should have played them, or would have played them. Which I did like the idea about saying we read it.
That sounds... Yeah, no, that sounds bonkers. Just
having a picture of Bradley Cooper without any context at the end.
And an American flag behind it.
Bradley Cooper went on to win 3 more Oscars.
So I watched Suburbicon. That is not a good film.
Suburbicon's great fun. It makes no sense.
It's two halves of two completely different films.
It's half a Coen Brothers film and half a George Clooney film. They don't fit together whatsoever. And the film does this weird thing where it tries to intertwine them, but it doesn't work.
The trailer looks awful.
Shrink?
No, that's the other terrible Matt Damon film. No.
I know, downsizing is less terrible.
No.
It's not good.
Downsizing is interminable is the issue with downsizing. Suburbicon at least is like 1:40, right?
It's true, yes, that is true.
Like, it ends.
When you get to the stage
the
where you're
comparing
runs
there's no real work.
How long did we have to endure this for?
And like, I feel... But
downsizing is a very strange film.
Downsizing is one of those great Paramount decisions. It's like, there's a movie about, where you know, an Alexander Payne film where a dude shrinks himself. Dude is played by Matt Damon. 180 million.
It's Alexander Payne playing with
Didn't cost 180 million. Please tell me that Paramount didn't waste that in an Alexander Payne film. You're never going to get your money back. You're never.
Matt Damon.
No, but on the other hand, let's sell the international distribution rights to Annihilation.
Right, moving swiftly on. In the news, Matt Damon. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck have decided that inclusion writers are going to be part of their...
Image rehabilitation. Production
Michael B.
Jordan
as well.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's great. It's great to see
that. A PR person came in and smacked him on the head and said, you better include this. You are going down the toilet, lads.
I will say, whatever about 3 billboards, and we're going to inevitably... We're going to inevitably get into that can of
worms.
We're
going to make a list of films that we can never
when
mention.
When we go into the top 10.
Christopher Nolan.
It's on the La La Land list. But one of the things that's interesting about 3 billboards, 3 billboards is the fact that like it's actually turned into a movie that does have that's had an impact in terms of 3 billboards as a mechanism of protest, for example.
But that's
in regards
not the
to
film.
No, I know.
Or to celebrate his achievement as it was...
I know. But in protest of like gun violence, like it becoming part of like a pop cultural discourse, which is fascinating for an Oscar nominated film, I think, in this day and age. When you look at the relatively small box office that they take, the dwindling ratings of the Oscars, like actually having a cultural impact is interesting.
But how long that'll be is an interesting
one. I'd rather if Selma had a cultural impact.
That's a fair point. That is a very fair point.
About
to have
the Oscar nominee film. Yeah.
We.
But yeah. Anyway, other news, the sad news, the shuttering of Filmbase. So, news emerged late yesterday, afternoon that, and it started hitting sort of social media and all the rest, that film base was being liquidated. This morning, nothing had happened. It was still just a mad rumor that was going around. And then this afternoon, Film Base issued a statement saying that, yes, it was true that they were closing down after 32 years of operations, and that due to mounting debt, essentially, that they had to go into voluntary liquidation. So this leaves an absolutely massive hole in the Irish film industry, because Film Base was instrumental in starting the career of, or at least helping towards, a lot of young filmmakers and emerging filmmakers get funding, get access to equipment, get access to courses and training, and a great many other things. So it's
and an information base, just people who walk in and ask.
Well, that's just
and even networking point.
Just as a meeting
equipment
point.
Hire.
Podcast venue.
Yeah,
as well. Yeah.
It was up until last week.
Up until yesterday evening.
Until about an hour ago.
Was the headquarters of the Scanon podcast.
Yeah, which is so.
But I mean, it had been around for 32 years.
32 years.
And
yeah.
It had been around, I think, during, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, after the disbanding of the original film board, right? So it filled that gap.
Yeah, so in 1985, they decided that a group of filmmakers got together with the notion of creating film based. Or a sort of community project for helping filmmakers in Ireland. 1986, they founded the Film Base itself, and Jane Gogan, who's at RTE, she's one of the head of drama programming there, she was the first director, and a number of high-profile filmmakers of the day were also members. Tiernan McBride, who the IFI Library is named after and is one of the most instrumental figures in Irish filmmaking, he was heavily involved in Film Base, especially after the disbanding of the Irish Film Board in 1987.
And the ludicrous decisions of various governments over the years, but and continues to this day.
Yeah.
Yep, so throughout the years they managed to survive that, the various different vagaries of Irish film financing and the rest. And so they were definitely throughout the late 80s and early 90s. In the early 90s they started funding short films as at first for like £3,500, and then it gradually got increased with cooperation with first RT, and then later with TG Carr, and still with RT as well. So the RT film base funding was going on up until last year. Then they were also responsible for the Arts Council's Real Arts scheme, so that was done via Film Base and via ADIF, and so each year the two films would end up playing at ADIF.
Some superb films that came out of that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the Masters film course in the last couple of years have produced features that have all played at the Galway Film Fla. They've all premiered at the Galway Film Fla. And so the Masters course is 2 months away from completion, so they're going to complete it.
That's decent. The
Masters students are...
Well, they believe they'll pay for this.
Are crowdfunding for... They do it all.
They do a feature. They crowdfund anyway.
Their crowdfund for the feature at the moment is called The Comeback.
That'll be the last production.
That will be the last production out of Film Base, yeah. So it's... It's not good.
No, well, I mean, people were sharing their stories and accounts online. I think Niall actually put together an article for Scanon. It may even be in Cinéire next month as well. But about the experiences that individuals had, like how formative it was for many of the people who work in the industry.
Well, that's it. If you go down through the list of the people who got funding from Film Base for shorts, it is the great and the good of Irish filmmakers. Essentially, they've touched almost everyone. Like in terms of production companies, they've almost all been in there. You know, the likes of Samson, Parallel, Who Made Brooklyn. You know, the all of them have been in there at some point. You have. Names like Kevin Liddy, Stephen Burke, who made his first film there, Lee Cronin, who's doing The Hole in the Ground now, he had a short in there, and John Kevill, who's the producer at Savage Pictures, he was involved as well, Catherine Kennedy, and the late Simon Fitzmaurice as well. It was just, Ian Reynolds had a short in there too. It's just crazy to think that some of the people like this wouldn't get a chance now.
There's an irony here that like it managed to somehow survive through austerity.
And now we're back in a boom time again.
Every article you see is trumping how much growth there is in all sectors. Well, like, and
there's a question to be asked about whether that's the case or not, or whether this is the long tail of a stereotype.
Oh, no, no, there is an argument, but I mean, there's still, like, I mean, if that's the case, then a closer look was needed, or whichever way you want to put it. Well, certainly there's a need for a film-based part two. I think John McGuire kind of tweeted that earlier, that it, as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Maybe a leaner or maybe a whatever kind more of efficient, operation, more but efficient. Something needs to be there. Yeah. You can't just leave that hole because...
I mean, one of the narratives that's come out possibly from people involved has been that it may not necessarily have been cuts that were responsible for the situation that we're in. But I mean, nobody knows, obviously. It's still...
The Arts Council and film-based are both cleared... have been both clear in their correspondence to say that it is an internal thing. It is the case that they were in a position where the debt was at an unserviceable rate.
But I think, isn't the point that the funding for this year is half of what it would have been last year?
Yes.
So in terms of servicing debt and going on...
They haven't drawn down anything from this year.
No, what I mean is that would not have helped had it managed to go on in regard... You know,
yes, that is the case. That didn't help, but...
It may not have been the death note.
No.
Stressor, perhaps, but nothing.
There's probably various reasoning shouldn't get into.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably being discussed by people who know more.
You're getting into the politics of of an organization that we're only tangential to. So it's
outside observers.
It's pretty tragic anyway, regardless of how it happened.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Because that, irrespective of whatever happened in terms of the finance of it, the fact that of what it does with for filmmakers, the offering of courses, because everybody has been on a course in terms of in the industry, everyone has been involved in some ways, has hired equipment at some point out of there, or has has somebody else on their team that is involved. Yeah. So it is a tragedy.
But I mean, even the use of the room as a space, or these the building as a space in the center of town as well, where people can congregate and come together, like as you pointed out, as a meeting ground or into the networking space.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that didn't help. That hasn't been modernized a lot. Yeah. It's gone a little bit shabby around the edges, but there's only so far you can stretch, you know, whatever you don't have, as it turns out.
Was there an argument for not having it in Temple Bar, perhaps? In terms of the just the real estate element of it, like that, it could mean somewhere else.
Well, I mean,
yeah, I know, I know.
It gets into the evolution of Dublin.
In the late 80s when it was almost a bus depot, right?
Yeah. It's easy to say that now, I guess, retrospectively.
And all of the arts organizations were kind of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Temple Bar is like its reputation, be what it may or may not be at 3 a.m. on a Saturday morning, is as like the cultural heart of.
But it's interesting that that's what Temple Bar has become, because it was an artistic. So the way that it has almost fueled its own destruction as that.
But there is something to be said that if it is to be reformed, that it happens in a new purpose-built building.
I would have thought that makes more sense.
Somewhere that it's easy to load and unload equipment from would be a very good start.
Yeah, but also somewhere that's accessible to people as well. Like, it can't be out in the middle of nowhere is the other side of that.
No, absolutely. That's true.
So where do you find in Dublin that is easily accessible for the heavy equipment and for movement and for loading?
And for podcasts.
And obviously, I mean, the real tragedy here, Jay. But no, seriously, more seriously though, somewhere that is accessible for people who are like either studying, going there for meetings, going there to use the facilities.
Well, I think the new, if I was to suggest somewhere and the kind of an area that does kind of cater and works in that sphere would be Smithfield.
Because it's
accessible. There's a lighthouse, there's Brown Bag Films, there's the creative hubs.
And it's down towards the end of Dublin as well. So
that would make sense to me, but
potentially the IFSC possibly as well.
Yeah, but there's nothing else there except me working.
But the IFSC is connected by the loop.
No, it is.
And you have the tunnel for public
transport.
You have to come all the way into town.
IFSC is not feasible because of the terms of what buildings go into the IFSC and the tax that is paid by them. And technically,
damn you and your knowledge.
The IFSC doesn't exist in Ireland. Yeah. So,
oh God, don't start telling me that. No, I'm about to get angry about things like that. No, let's not do that.
Right.
Count backwards from 10.
Right. Okay. Let's pretend it's in Ireland because it works there.
Jay has to check his passport every morning.
No,
you can hear him. Jay is breathing into a paper bag.
It's a designated special economic area.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
So, Charlie Hunnam.
It's its own section, if you will.
Yeah, so stop. Let's park it now. Angry.
Let's move on to the top 10.
Yay!
Yeah. I never thought Jay would be happy.
Me neither.
To move on to the top 10.
Oh, zero, yeah.
Are you feeling quite all right, Jason?
I am fine. Thank you.
So, at 10, have you got in for the turn?
I didn't realize that was my role here. No, I'm on it now.
I forgot.
This is what happens when we don't organize or synchronize. I have it right here, so give me 2 seconds, and I will just reload it.
This is what our venue loss has cost us.
Yeah,
we're all just sitting here.
Number 10.
The ultimate tragedy.
Number 10, we have Monster Family.
Monster Family, the Sky Arts one, or Sky Cinema one. Yeah.
The Sky Ad.
It is the Sky Ad. It's a Sky Broadband commercial that is expanded.
That's the thing. Yeah. I didn't even know it was a film. That's the weird new, it's the new like McDonald's Happy Meal tie-in is advertising broadband, or DFS in the case of early man. This is the new vertical.
I love the fact that we're now aiming for kids' entertainment is designed to sell sofas.
It's very strange.
And broadband
Inside Out sold Sky as well.
At the Toy Story.
Toy Story.
It's goddamn sacrilege.
Yeah, you're right. The movie that features Rock'em Sock'em Robots and Mr. Potato Head would never bow to commercialism. I love Toy Story. I think Toy Story is amazing.
Toy Story is brilliant, but it's a brilliant toy commercial.
Yeah.
Ooh, it is. I like the fact that Jay started kicking me, and Ronan was like, no.
Hang on. There's nothing wrong with toy commercials. There's nothing wrong with toys.
Exactly.
Like, that's a good thing. I'm just saying, selling broadband to people is not a great look, in my opinion.
Okay.
As a father of a child who's obsessed with Toy Story and has all of the toys, I have absolutely no problem with it.
I have no problem with it either.
I have a lot of problems with the selling of
that's what I'm talking about.
No, but with Toy Story.
Toy Story's great.
Yeah, the Toy Story films are amazing.
And the toys that grew up around it. No problem. Done. At 9, 3 billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
How is that still hanging on?
Because it's a great movie. At number 8. Sorry.
How long has it been there now?
9 weeks.
2 years.
That's impressive.
It's earned a total of 2.2 million euro, which is pretty impressive, particularly when you compare it to the whole...
I gave my money to that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I didn't.
That's...
Jay's unimpressed with himself.
2.2.
Very unimpressed.
500% of the takings of Shape of Water so far. Although, obviously, Shape of Water entered a month later, but still.
Yeah.
Okay. Gross.
And ish. Shape of Water.
Yay.
Which, you know, it's better.
Yeah.
Shape of Water's brand.
It is better. It's just not great. It's not as good.
The Academy Award winning Shape of Water went up 250.
I didn't get like an ordinary day, Grace, but I did quite like it.
It's a perfectly serviceable Best Picture winner. In fact, I'm surprised that anybody... It's actually quite a brave Best Picture winner in some ways. Grinding Nemo, in the words of Stacey Grout.
But you never actually see this. I really feel like this kerfuffle has been exaggerated.
I don't mean in that way. I mean in the fact that it's a fantasy film that won the Oscar.
It's a fantasy film coated with like love of cinema, though. Like it's got like a Red Shoes reference for no other reason than to have a black and white dance sequence.
It adds to its charm, like, you know, its exploration of internal lives and people's perspectives.
I'm a little more cynical on it, but I'm not gone on Del Toro as much as most.
That's probably where my
I'm actually really happy for Del Toro.
He seems like a really nice guy, which is a bonus. So I'm happy with that. And he beat Martin McDonagh.
Martin McDonagh wasn't even in the running.
I thought of the Best Picture.
Del Toro, the Del Griffin movie directors.
Nah, good on him.
Yeah.
At 7, it's Coco.
Yeah, it's good.
It's grand.
It's better than Darren thinks it is.
We're not getting into this. At 6,
it's mid tier Pixar.
At 6, Red Sparrow.
That's not good. We talked about this last week. That's not good.
I haven't seen it,
and it's not doing good either.
Is it not doing well?
It's a shame, actually, because it's not a good film, but I'm happy to see Lawrence doing this sort of thing, like this and Mother. In terms of, it's weird that an actor after winning their 2 Oscars, let's repeat that, after winning their 2 Oscars, actually makes a point to be adventurous in their roles. She has 2, doesn't she?
Yes. She won for Actress and Best Supporting Actress.
Yes, I believe she did for American Hustle and
I'm glad she's doing terrible movies like Mother. I'm really delighted for her ex-husband, or Joy.
But I think that there's something like legitimately adventurous in the way that Lawrence is doing.
Fine,
I'm happy to see that. I'm very happy
I'm
to
not
see
happy
it.
To see it. So but I yeah, seen it.
Red,
did you
see no, but you should.
I did. It's off. Did you hate it?
Appalling.
You should. It's, once I'm glad that it got made. I'm very glad that it got
you
made.
You know, I really enjoyed Mother, but in yeah, the same way that you enjoy someone babbling down the street.
It's just absorbing it.
It's, yeah. It's a sight to yeah, behold.
Once
yeah,
you get it, is that. It's like,
well,
okay,
that's it.
Yeah,
it spends the next
now,
40 minutes hammering you over the head.
You know, the worst part of Mother for me, though, more than any of the craziness. No, no. I
thought that was a nice arc. It's I thought they really flooded the symbolism
stop,
there.
It's how heavy.
It was no a bad idea, if you ask
stop,
me. I'm sorry, I'm getting all these in, as many as I'm
just
able.
Just be quiet.
Oh.
How heavily, Jennifer Lawrence walks around in heels around that house. Mm-hmm. It really, really irked me.
Really?
That's my takeaway.
That's your line?
There you go.
That sounds like the type of thing that would annoy me. I have not seen Mother.
Grace, watch it and see if it does annoy you. Because now you'll think about it.
Fascinating film.
It is.
So
it's a weird
No, I'm amazed that it got like a major release from
yeah,
Paramount again
yeah,
in a recurring theme of this podcast.
I would argue that Noah is a weirder film for Aronofsky and a much better film.
Noah's much better.
Yeah, okay. Noah is much, much better.
Anyway, so the film we're talking about, though, Red Sparrow, not great, not tacky enough to be a guilty pleasure, not smart enough to be as dark as it wants to be.
All right,
and back to Jennifer Lawrence and the Academy Awards. One for Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, okay.
I just,
wow.
I really felt like I would write.
Three Golden Globes.
Ah, there we go. I averaged them out.
I thought she'd another Oscar as well.
Yes,
yeah.
No.
There we go.
Nominated quite a lot, though.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
that would be the issue.
Should have gone for Winter's Bone. Anywho. Stop it.
Yes, we're going to move on. And at five, The Greatest Showman, Dancing Is Weird.
For the fifth year.
Absolutely yeah, staggering.
11
we should start measuring time in after The Greatest Showman.
I haven't seen it. I feel I should see it.
In the Mad Max apocalypse.
Just sort of hanging around.
In the Mad Max apocalypse, Greatest Showman is still number four at the box office.
You know your thing earlier, this was pre-podcast, where Darren proposed everybody watching the 24-hour channel of Happy. In The Greatest Showman on continuous repeat.
There are people who seem to experience it like that, and I'm very happy for them. Every time I've gone to the cinema in my local cinema in Swords, there's always been a gaggle of young women who are going to see The Greatest Showman, and they're so excited. No, they love it, and it's amazing to see that enthusiasm.
It's an extraordinary repeat business. I've seen loads of people talk about it, seen it third or fourth time.
For yeah, people who've yeah, seen it already, who are so excited to be going to the cinema, people talk about cinema being dead.
I
like
hated
having
the song on the Oscars from it, though. I hated it so much. It was
which
bad,
ones they do?
All
was
of
it
the Oscar
the,
songs seemed to be kind of badly
yeah,
performed.
Well, I mean,
they didn't come across well.
Well, I mean, they also picked the wrong song in some cases, like
yeah,
They Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, they yeah, absolutely
but,
did. No, they did.
Sorry.
Was it This Is Me was the Oscar pick from Greatest
I
Showman, was
think
it?
So. I was too busy curdling up behind the couch in tears watching it to find out the exact name.
It wasn't good.
It wasn't good.
Jesus,
I was delirious at that point.
It was
3 a.m.
It was not The Greatest Showman.
That was a fun night, though. Anyway,
I wonder how much of The Greatest Showman's business is kind of motivated by. At this point, it's been there so long that I'm like, maybe I'll go.
Yeah,
me too.
I love that. I love that. Despite the fact The Greatest Showman is at number 5 and has been there since December, and I think we have 5 people in the room right
yeah,
now who love cinema,
the only
who have not seen it.
The only gathering.
My feelings on musicals are well known.
Yeah.
Everybody
with
else,
Zac Efron. That's like
we tried to book more people for this podcast, but they were all
one
watching
us,
The Greatest Showman.
One of us should see it by next week. Let's draw straws again in the podcast.
Myself
I don't
and
you
should
draw straws.
As
Niall says, you know, musical with Zac Efron. I'm there.
So
scan on movie time night. I think we could do it.
All right, let's see what happens.
We'll
tune in next week, lads.
Yeah.
We're
cinema is right down the road.
Where we'll also have 6 guests who will never seen The Greatest Showman.
How about we just go out and round up people who haven't seen The Greatest Showman and just bring them along?
That's the criteria.
At least this
for
is
me,
not getting weird, though. That's the main thing.
Well, I'm saying the choices are that or Damon either.
No.
Greatest Showman.
But we'll talk about that later.
At 4, I, Tanya, which we've already
yeah,
talked about.
Yep.
And
fine,
it's great.
Fine.
Like something like that, I'm happy enough to see it do well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At 3, Darren's favourite film of the last month, Game Night.
I actually really love this film. It maybe is it
you
the best?
You haven't talked about it a lot.
Is it the best film of the past? Well, it may be. Come on, David Fincher movie from 1997 that everybody but the five people in this room have forgotten existed, remade as a high concept comedy.
Has people really forgot about the game?
The game is.
I think the game is had some
not well known. But
it's overshadowed by obviously Seven.
It's one of Fincher's least well known. Yeah, absolutely.
But it's not unknown. It's not like, you know, rare David Fincher post college film. Like, you know, it's.
it's
which I want to see.
Much like Cronenberg scary.
Yeah. But we are. We're talking something like. I mean,
I saw the cinema back in the day. Like.
Even Panic Room, I would argue, had a greater cultural impact than.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I don't think I was old enough to see it in the cinema.
Yeah. Game? Sure. I saw the game in the cinema. I saw all Fincher films.
Like, it would have been 20 years later, somebody's like, yeah, let's make a comedy. And take that concept from that movie that nobody went to see 20 years ago.
I did.
I
was there, Jeff.
Old Man Coyle. They just
get off my lawn.
I remember they just introduced talkies.
Jay leaning in with the cigarette going, that's a name I've not heard.
yes. Very good.
While smoking in the cinema watching the film.
When you could do in those days in the 1920s.
Yeah. But yeah, Game Night's fantastic. Everybody, if
I do actually want to catch
there
it,
there are better films in the top 10. There are better films coming out. There are probably no better films coming out this week. So if you've seen everything in the top 10, go and see this, and see Mom and Dad.
What a great show!
I want to see that, and I want to see Mom and Dad at some stage.
Yeah, Mom and Dad definitely.
I'm seeing Mom and Dad side.
But importantly, Game Night.
Actually, I'll talk my mom into going to cinema. Sorry, that's me thinking out loud.
Right.
Go on.
We're all thinking out loud. This is thinking out loud section of the podcast.
Yes.
Did I leave the oven on?
Double bill. Great showman and Game Night. There we go. Right. Sorted. At two, Lady Bird.
Yay. Down from one.
The best film at the Oscars. The best film I've seen this year.
Let's not start that.
Right in there.
Okay.
Best film of 2018. I'd be delighted if something beats it, but I don't see
it.
Oh, you were never really here as already.
No, that's number three, I think, for me.
I don't think I'm as wildly as enthusiastic, but I love it. I really love it.
Yeah. I'm glad to see it doing well.
Me too.
I'm very happy for it.
Me too.
No, it's a very good film. It's enjoyable. It's got a set of charming performances. It's got a very good script. It's good.
It's wonderful.
Say it's grand.
It's pretty wonderful.
It's not grand. It's a little better than grand. It's a shame.
Good.
It deserves to be on the list of nominees, but that's
yes.
No
maybe.
More.
Oh, that was cutting. What I mean, that was very subtle.
What I mean, the alternative was the Florida Project, right?
dangerous turf.
Darren. Darren hates movies.
Darren loves movies.
I think Lady Bird is a perfectly well-made version of that type of film, which is...
It's also a
much better film of that type of film than anybody could reasonably expect or hope for.
Counterpoint.
I think it's a brilliant film.
Counterpoint, Mom and Dad. It is basically...
Lady Bird is so many times better than
Lady Bird and Mom and Dad are the same movie. I'm just pitching it now.
I'm extremely enthusiastic about Mom and Dad. I love seeing a Nick Cage movie where somebody likes to use Nick Cage. But Lady Bird is
same concept.
Miles is better.
I will see it on Saturday and I'll let you know, Larry.
At one, Black Panther.
The king retaking his crown.
Still haven't seen it. I really will get to it.
Jason will reevaluate
very
his best.
I may well.
Somehow I doubt it. But
you've seen it, Chris?
Yeah.
It's great.
Like all sensible people, I've seen.
Everybody who hasn't seen The Greatest Showman.
I must double bill them. It's an afternoon.
Yeah. No, I don't really like Black Panther. It's very conventional, but it's fun, it's innovative, it's got this sort of like, it's got this verve and energy, and it's wonderfully well executed, as you would expect from Coogler.
And the bad guy has the best morals.
The bad guy is basically the good guy, is the issue with the film, it's the film's biggest issue. But,
is that an issue, or is that? I'm sure they knew what they were doing with that.
Oh no, they knew what they were doing.
I think, like, when you create a villain that's, you know, maybe not... Well, not ideal, but like the type of villain that is incredibly sympathetic, that genuinely makes you pause and consider his point of view, as opposed to just being token, I want to kill everyone because reasons, bad guy.
But I mean, compared to most other Marvel villains.
Yeah, and grounding it in a kind of a political and social reality that has, you know, been oft discussed, misunderstood as well.
One of the interesting aspects of Black Panther is the fact that the villain is what the right wing in America thinks that Black Panther is. Like, I mean, one of the most interesting descriptions of Black Panther that I've read is it's a debate between black liberalism versus black radicalism, with obviously T'Challa and most obviously the women around him, who are under discussed in reviews, because it does have a wonderful bench of supporting female characters representing the ideal of black liberalism. And obviously Killmonger.
But also insular.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, no, no. Yeah. I mean, that's the journey that they take as well. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a really weird movement to try and appropriate Black Panther as a MAGA movie, which fundamentally misunderstands the arc of the movie completely, in that, you know, it misunderstands how the film ends.
Yeah. Going to the MAGA and movies thing.
There's a new podcast idea, MAGA at the movies.
No, I have to try to live through the season.
No.
Let's not get too bad at this.
Blood pressure rising.
Earlier this week, Trump gave a campaign rally speech for a guy in Pennsylvania who was being elected.
Yeah.
At it, said that MAGA is not going to be the slogan for the re-election. Instead, it's going to be Keep America Great, otherwise known as the tagline from the Purge election year.
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, come on, that's not entirely unpredictable, if we're being honest. Who would have seen The Purge being one of the most politically relevant movies of the past 4 years?
Or The Purge episode of Rick and Morty.
Yeah. The thing with Black Panther is that it's not revolutionary, but it is liberal, and it's thoughtful, and it's clearly very personal. It means a lot to Coogler, and it means a lot to the actors working as well.
Yeah, I think it's revolutionary in a quiet way. You know, it's like the storytelling beats, the arcs, all of that, they are very familiar in many respects, but I think the fact that it's being explored through such a perspective that is not often represented, at least not represented respectfully on screen, that does make it.
Well, I mean,
it feels like something very fresh and new, even if when you drill down to it.
Well, there's also like
that
even
is exactly my argument for Lady Bird, incidentally.
That's also my argument for Mudbound as well, hits these familiar tropes, but tells him you haven't heard the story told.
But,
in that
Bird has such a beautiful mother-daughter relationship in it that's so authentic and raw, and like everything about it is just perfectly observed. And I feel like, Not to be massively generalistic, but, you know, I feel like if you haven't had a relationship like that in your life, it might go right over your head. But I cannot overemphasize how much when Lady Bird ended, I wanted to call my mother and apologize to her for ever being a horrible person. But, yeah, and I mean, I think I said this last week, but I don't think, like, if you compare it, say, for example, to the mother-daughter relationship in I, Tonya, which is something that we've seen a lot where it's just full of, well, in that case, explicit violence, but a lot of kind of emotional, abusive behavior, and, you know, everything is just very negative. And I think in Lady Bird, they explore how those tensions can, in certain circumstances, maybe become that extreme, but it's also just a factor of life, and it's a part of what makes people really love each other as much as they may really hate each other, and how it sort of, I don't know, it underpins a family dynamic. It doesn't always have to be something that's destructive. It can be something that brings you together as well. And considering, like, Lady Bird, it seems like a very simple story with very, like, the performances in it are great, but they're very naturalistic, you know. They're the type of performances that don't immediately seem great because they seem very...
I thought they were immediately great. Like, I thought Metcalf and Ronan,
but you know how, like, they settle into those roles so well that sometimes it goes over your head how much effort is going into it.
I think subtlety in performances, particularly around awards, it's the ones that are the loudest acting in capital letters that get rewarded.
Gary Oldman and his fat suit.
Gary Oldman's your...
never.
I think it's the true line for most of the acting awards, to be honest, that won.
Yeah.
That are the louder.
It was a particularly poor grand election.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, like
I would strongly disagree.
Do you
pretty much
you like
across
them
the
all?
Board?
Like,
surely best supporting actor.
Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, Rockwell. Then Janney.
Rockwell,
Janney, McDormand, and
all
wouldn't have given it to any of them.
All of them, actors who I've loved in the past, who have done
great work
and give them a career achievement by all means.
But not for any of those.
But that's the thing. I feel like all of those acting awards were given to people because we like them as actors, not because we like.
But that's
those
always the way that the Oscars have worked, though.
I know, but these are ridiculous.
And I have to say, just give him an Oscar before he kills himself.
Wolf of Wall Street was right there.
Scorsese and
The Aviator was right there. Let's go back.
The Aviator,
I think,
go on Basketball.
I think in terms of acting, though, I think because the awards were given to particularly shouty, loud, give me an award type performances,
I'm just going to swear a lot.
Or yell
a lot.
I think you undersell those performances, with the exception maybe Oban.
I actually don't think I do. I think it's a theme for those awards that like, I felt that I made this point like previous
but, I mean,
to the Oscars.
The Oscars in general are like, I mean, you're never going to see a wonderful supporting performance win. You're never going to see a quiet, nuanced.
You do though sometimes.
It has been.
Yeah.
I can't
and there will be in the future, no doubt. It's not like they're all.
There's
terrible.
Usually one or two that's kind of like I don't know, but this was for all the awards to go to ones that weren't great.
But generally they're loud, and I don't mean loud in like a volume level. I mean loud in like we're acting.
Yeah, this is nothing new, but I suppose the four of them taken together, it creates a sort of portrait of what the Academy and maybe the public look at as acting that will influence what people do going forward.
But I mean, like,
which is worrying.
Anthony Hopkins winning lead actor for 17 minutes of...
I love that performance.
I think that performance is fantastic.
Judi Dench got a supporting actress Oscar for
like
what?
Eight minutes
screen time?
Yeah.
Awards. No, I don't care how long it is. The impact that you should have.
But as much as cramming scenery in, like again, Dench, that performance is not subtle. That performance is feed.
I remember Baldwin in the Mammoth.
Why does Daniel Baldwin, not just Baldwin. Yeah, but he's got a very short time.
And what I think was interesting about the Oscars this year is that you can see sort of the collision between the old and the new in the way all of the typical things like Darkest Hour, Billboards, whatever, were all nominated. But you also had recognition for something like Get Out, The Big Sick, Call Me By Your Name. And you can see how maybe over time it might move towards a slightly more progressive
interpretation.
Anyway, moving back to Black Panther.
The Dunkirk Revolution.
Well, we went way off track.
Okay, well, very, very quickly, just on Black Panther. One of the things we talked about being a personal film for Coogler. Like, the film opens in Oakland, California in 1992 when he would have been a kid. It opens on three black kids looking to the sky
in
wonder.
It opens in the birth city of the Black Panther.
It opens on watching this kid watching this ship fly through the sky and imagining. It has this wonderful story like, Papa, tell me the story of home. Mm-hmm. And it's got this wonderful sort of personal story.
Oh, if you put Papa, tell me the story of hope at the start of any home, that's going to be our home. Now you're still like, oh.
No, it's this idea of like a spiritual connection to an Africa that never existed because of colonialism and imperialism, but one that exists in the imagination and in hope. Yeah. And I think that the film, I think Black Panther taps into that in a way that really resonates.
Yeah, but that can only exist because of its unbelievable natural resource. You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Africa itself, though, the continent of Africa is geographically one of the richest continents on the planet. Like, if the residents of that continent, not to get too political, had access or control to those resources, they would be doing very well for themselves.
Also, you can call it true line in terms of Oscars and the story of Churchill and the oil in the Middle East in the 40s as well, if you really want to get on that.
The
control
of Churchill,
BP
the
and all that
human.
Kind of thing. So, you know, it's, you're right. It's, yes, but it, there are colonial...
No, it definitely is. And like that's the thing about Black Panther, is that it embraces the possibility of a superhero film. A superhero film, at its best, represents an ideal. It's something to aspire to.
I know, I agree.
An aspiration. And Black Panther taps into that as a cultural concept, which is beautiful.
Even pulling their punches, as they do with an awful lot of the films that they make, Marvel... are still willing to at least try something, which the other Beck and
eventually having got to the point where they sort of see that they can.
But you have Civil War, or you have Winter Soldier attempting to do it.
I think Winter
Soldier
was very, very good.
Yes,
I would go as far as to call it brilliant.
What?
Winter
Soldier.
I think it's good.
The movie where all the problems with modern America could be traced back to actual literal Nazis. From Germany.
No,
from the perspective.
Like, just so we're clear, this is the level of commentary in.
Very true.
It absolutely pulls its punch on that, but I'm saying in terms of setting.
That's its only punch, though.
I'm saying in terms of setting it up as a genre piece, it does. That's where I'm saying Marvel deserves some credit for that. They don't.
And Winter Soldier usurps a ton of the world building they've spent a ton of films doing as well. They're like, oh, all of these things that are important, psych. They're not here anymore, you know?
Also, because Samuel Jackson has used 7 of the 9 films in his contract, so we kind of need to get him out.
Yeah. All right.
Back to Black Panther for a second. The box office.
Yes.
Oh, my dear God, the box office. It is now the second highest grossing Marvel film of all time in America.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. And any day now will pass Avengers. It will.
It's going to set up.
It's going to pass Avengers. Yeah. It's 70 million behind us, and it's making 6 wow. million a day. It is amazing. Passing Avengers. There is no doubt about that.
And I haven't even seen it again yet.
It's aiming for the top. It's aiming for. It won't get to Avatar level.
But will it get to Force Awakens even? Will it get past Jurassic World? Right?
It's getting past Jurassic World.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, we'll actually have a good top four. Or a reasonable top four.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. Like, I mean, it's just not stopping.
It could get past Titanic.
Which would be great. The second.
Probably will.
Imagine a film directed by an African American about an African country, about a black superhero. Being the second highest grossing film of all time.
America great again.
That is making America great, and that would have been unimaginable, like, in the boardroom when this was pitched. It took Marvel nearly 10 years to get around to doing this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is what happens when you actually pay attention to an audience that is there.
It needs to continue, as it does, for 3 more weeks, and it will beat Titanic.
Easy.
That is extraordinary.
Yeah, and that's it. So at the moment, it's on 570 million, and it's aiming for... Well, yeah, whatever. It's 570 million Americans, 1.1 billion worldwide. So,
yikes.
Pretty good. Anyway, new releases, quickly.
Yes, hit me with them. What do you got?
Well,
you better be good,
Lyle. Eager to know what movies he's going to hit next week.
Yes.
You want to know what you're going to hit next week?
What am I going to hate next week? Tell me.
We should call this the What Jay's Going to Hate Next Week section of the podcast.
Don't we already?
No. Okay, there are several candidates. Mary Magdalene is out, which I haven't seen.
Jesus.
see what you did there.
Peter Rabbit.
James Corden?
James Corden is
in it. James Corden is Peter Rabbit.
He plays Satan.
Oh, really?
Donald Gleeson, though, is playing Mr. McGregor.
Sam Neill is playing Mr.
McGregor,
and
Donald is
playing Son. At least
Get
the mythology.
Donald needs to get a new agent for the
Peter Rabbit extended universe.
Yeah, I know.
Great thing from the roundtable interview, though. They were like, isn't Peter Rabbit a British institution? Donald Gleeson goes, I don't know, I'm Irish.
Make Ireland great again. Sorry. Miga.
What
roundtable
interview was this?
There was in England. It was a roundtable interview with a lot of directors.
There were Knights of the Round Table.
The Square, which I really am excited
I'm
about.
Quite interested. Oh,
one of the
ones
that 40 minutes long or whatever.
Yeah.
It is.
What?
It's about it's long.
It's 2 hours and 22.
My apologies.
Those 18 minutes make all the difference.
That is very long. I don't know.
I quite like Force Majeure.
Aslan can do this thing where he holds out these awkward scenarios for a very long time.
But that seems like a long time.
Well, but that does seem like a...
I'll probably get to him.
It's got a great cast.
Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Which is not good, but it's also possibly the best film that I've seen out this week.
Little White Lies gave Tomb Raider 5 stars.
Yeah, Little White Lies are wrong.
Well, they're going against the grain.
Vikander's great film. Vikander is a charming leading actor and should be doing more.
What about Walton Goggins? The real reason we're going to see him.
You
said it.
He is there.
He's
suitably menacing. It's just an underwritten character whose job is primarily to provide background menace.
He did cold again. There's a moment.
It's still too much.
It's not a great film. It takes itself overly seriously. It's a video game adaptation from people who believe the best part of playing a video game is watching the cutscenes. It opens with an exposition scene explaining
watching somebody else play a video game.
It opens with an exposition scene that explains the tomb that is going to be raided, which means that I miss when 80s action movies began with like a sequence of action introducing you to the character, much like, say, the Indiana Jones films had like the dinner scene in Temple of Doom.
My favourite opening scene to establish a character ever, and I mean ever, was the film Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen.
Yes.
Who introduces character who wakes up in the sea and stands up and walks out of the water in his full clothes.
Yeah.
He's a rebel. He goes out drinking.
Yeah.
It's magnificent.
It's missing,
and terrible. It's so great.
It's missing that sort
don't
of
don't ever
aspect.
Watch it. It's
terrible. A film. It's filled with all this mythology, all this reference to stuff that people who were watching the film don't care about and just want to get to the tomb raiding, which only takes place in the final 20 minutes.
For heaven's sake. Where, at what point do they lock the butler in the fridge?
There is no butler. It's got that.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I'm out.
It's got this thing where. This thing.
Even the Angelina Jolie movie had your man from Red Dwarf playing the butler.
But it has
I've never seen that.
It has this weird thing where it's ashamed of the character's aristocratic background.
That is
so she becomes a bike courier around London, so she's street and hip and stuff.
What is even Premium Rush?
I know. It has
that. Like Premium
Rush is so much fun.
Michael Shannon,
what the hell is Premium Rush?
Oh, oh, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a courier.
And Michael Shannon as a corrupt cop.
It's, you know what? What? It's like Crank.
Yeah.
It's the
go watch it.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, it's an action
brilliant
movie about bike messengers with Michael Shannon.
Oh, yeah, I'm on it this weekend. That's the fourth movie added to the Paddy's Day extravaganza.
It's one of my favorite Michael Shannon performances because he
it's
just
Michael
goes
Shannon
at
doing
that. Abandon,
we have
which
never
is never
heard
not true.
Do I look like a guy you want to mess with?
Okay, this is on.
I went through a month at one point where I wouldn't shut up about it on Twitter because I was so almost muted.
I gave it a 4-star review on Skinon when it came out.
As if I do that.
It's so not again.
Tomb Raider isn't even the best movie about bike messengers then. Moving on.
The other two releases this week are Irish.
Yeah, hit me with it.
Damo and Ivor.
Yeah, hit me with it.
And Unless. Darren, so Darren,
do you
which
take
one
unless
of them do you hate more?
Unless.
Oh, okay.
It's an easy one. Damo and Ivor is terrible. So Unless is basically, if somebody listened to the first two verses of Common People by Pulp and thought they would base an entire film around it. It's about a wealthy upper middle class family who discover that their daughter is living homeless on the streets. They're trying to figure out why she would do such a thing, why she would give up the comfort that she has. And basically it becomes this existential sort of middle class angst story. It's not good. It's very not good.
And Damo and Ivor is worse.
Damo and Ivor is not worse, but it's still very, very bad. Damo and Ivor is an adaptation of the comedy. It's a road trip movie like other film television to film adaptations like The Muppet Movie and even the Hardy Books movie from a couple of years back. It's a film that is tired, exhausted. It hits all the expected jokes and then either A, explains them in painstaking detail when they weren't funny the first time, or B, pushes them in an incredibly crass direction which aims towards the lowest common denominator. It's not a good film. Don't go see this.
I won't.
And on that note, we'll leave it there.
Farewell.
Bye-bye.
Adios. Thank you.
I never forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on. Huh?